would have to file their candidate statements before they were even nominated by the minor party or by petition of individual electors. Major arguments would have to be filed 3 weeks before the deadline for petitioners to even file their signatures for verification, and 7 weeks before it is known through the signature verification process which petitions have qualified to the ballot and what their major numbers are. Furthermore, the voter's pamphlet, once all that information was compiled, it would have to be edited, printed, and mailed 10 days after the measures are certified to the ballot. To produce a measure's volume of the voter's pamphlet, such as the first volume of our now two-volume general election voter's pamphlet, requires 3 weeks of production, just to let the ink dry so that the volume can be found and then delivered to the mail, to the Postal Service. In initiative petitions, and in this case in particular, and to some lesser degree with the August date, county elections officials and the state Secretary of State's office would be verifying state initiative signatures at the same time they're printing primary ballots and mailing out the absentee primary ballots, which are out-of-state and military ballots. The ballot themselves, the state general election ballot, would have to be certified before the official primary election results were known. Further, that date for certifying the state ballot, the final official results that the governor signs of the races and measures in the primary, is the same date that all absentee ballots have to be printed and made available and also mailed to long-term absentee and military voters. That's just not likely to happen. That is also true of local candidates, that under the bill, their deadline is for cities to certify to a county clerk what city candidates, what city measures, or special districts the same, would be on the general election ballot for that unit of local government is also the same day as we certify the state ballot to the county, and that they're supposed to have these printed and made available both at the elections office and mailed to out-of-state military voters. One of the more awkward components of this is in recount and contest law that we can assuage to some extent with an August date, but the September date would require automatic recounts. That's less of 1/5 of 1% difference between the top two candidates. Would have to be conducted after the general election ballot is certified and absentee and military ballots are mailed to voters. So if it was a close race, we wouldn't even know who was on the ballot, or we'd have to take the ostensive front runner by a hair, in some cases one vote, and put them on the ballot. And so the best we can guess is that if the automatic recount turned around the results, which it seldom does, that we'd have to declare a vacancy in the office, not just a vacancy in nomination.
Okay.
demands for recounts and even contest election where there's been a material error in the production or distribution of the ballot would have to be made before all ballots are counted, and so you wouldn't even
know.
And again, the results of those would not be known before the general election ballots had to be printed.
For folks that are perhaps watching this on TV, you have this in miniature in front of you, but this graphically lays out those conflicts. Here's your September primary, here's your November general. The real nut of the matter, well, first of all, are the filing deadlines for the general that precede and overlap with the conduct of the primary election. Then people vote, and then here's trying to tally those votes and certify the results. At the same time, this ballot has to be printed and made available. And so that's September, first Tuesday in September. The committee chairs charge to Senator Atkinson, and the working group was to come up with the closest to that date that would possibly work.
Okay, so September, going once. Gone. All right. What can you do?
The second half of your packet is the possible alternative of the working group.
What did you just do? You went nuts? I left the room and you started throwing things.
Senator Beyer.
Just to be real clear, before we throw it over our shoulder too far, a lot of this stuff, except for the recount, you could change by moving the dates on other things. This is based on things being the same.
No. Legislative Council did a very good job for Senator Atkinson in changing dates already. For instance, it moved the date to mail military and out-of-state absentee ballots from the 45th day before the election to the 40th day before the election, so that before the general, so that there could be some time in there, but it still comes up with that same date. Counties don't even know what's on the ballot until the very day that they have to print it and mail it.
I was trying to get at things like the minor and independent parties' filings. You just require them to file earlier. Changing the day of when you could get initiative measures on, that just means you ratchet that process back. Maybe you're a year out rather than that.
So that's right, and we wanted to cover. We'll cover that with you. That's true.
It's the vote.
So you're down to the verification of the vote?
Actually, from the actual filing deadline for people to submit, that the conflict comes there, because what you have is that your September election, you don't know the results to be able to certify a ballot for the general until a later date, because you don't know the results until later. And so what that created is having to push the filing deadline closer to the general election date.
So the issue is how quickly you can count the ballots?
No, we know how quickly we can count the ballots, and it takes close to 20 days. And our alternative, we've shortened that somewhat, and we've come up with an interim step that I'll describe shortly, that it's a summary of ballots counted as of this day results that then would trigger.
What takes so long?
Well,
there's several factors. First of all, you do have, because of the filing, close of the election day, you still may be getting ballots from other counties. In Oregon law, they can deposit their ballot at any location, official location throughout the state. We do get people who will cast their ballot in Multnomah County, that's for Lane County. We oftentimes are still counting ballots the next week.
That's not a constitutional issue, though, is it? That's a statute.
Well, no, as I started out our testimony, is that to comply with Oregonians' expectations of how elections are conducted, when I was in Senator Harper's county seat the day before the general election, we had someone who was working on a construction job in Klamath Falls, but they were a Linn County voter. And so the Klamath County clerk provided them a ballot so that they could vote the state issues, the issues that were on the Klamath County ballot that they were eligible to vote for on in Linn County. And that's a ballot that then the Klamath County will transmit with the person's voter registration information to Linn County within, basically, they have to mail it the next day, but sometimes it takes up to 8 days for those to get through the postal
process. I mean, you're talking about expectations. I'm not sure that I would agree with you that that's the general public's expectation, that I can pick up a ballot in Klamath Falls and expect it to be in Albany on election day. And I think most people would assume.
There are actually a very high percentage, I mean, it's significant, it's not by any means a majority, of voters that are, the counties will mail their ballots out to their voters in other counties in the state, because that's where they are now. That's where they've requested they get their ballot. this is not a Bethlehem situation where you must go back to the town in which you were born to be counted for taxation purposes.
What is that?
But instead that you...
However, there might be a realistic... It's not Florida either, or Washington, where we're going to count the ballots after Election Day, and if they get them, they don't get them back on time. That's their problem.
Only if you're sensitive to the concerns of getting those ballots by Election Day or as soon thereafter as possible. Telling.
We did have a short conversation.
Sounds like the Bethlehem thing.
Feel free to change any of the statutes that you thought might fit. But yeah. You were in Klamath County a day ahead of the election?
I was in Lake
North
County.
Of the sheriff noticed I was here. I got to check. I had a breakdown here somewhere.
I was quick. I stayed a long time in Jackson County that week. So with the tally, do you want to...
Well, I'd like to just expand that a little bit better, explain that it's more than just tallying the ballots, because part of our process is reconciling the tally of ballots. And that's really quite important, because going through the process systematically and making sure that, number one, you've got your activity given to all the voters and you have your ballot count and you reconcile the two, the ballot count against the precinct activity given, to make sure that your ballots are counting correctly through your machines. Accountability and making sure that our count is accurate is pretty important, and that takes time, and that's part of that certification process.
Week?
In some cases, the 20th day is adequate. Certainly, we can get done sooner in a lot of circumstances.
What's the 20th day?
20th day is what our current statutory, we have till the 20th day to certify our election results. And we
20th day after the election?
Correct. And currently what we do is we complete the ballot count, which would be those last ones. And there's a fair amount that still use that. Plus we have a mail election. So ballots, when we actually pick them up from the post office that night, and sometimes we get ballots from other counties and have to extend it. So it's more than just people voting in other counties as well. But then at the conclusion of that, we complete our write-in process. We complete any of the challenge ballots that maybe signatures, we were dealing with signatures, or maybe the wrong person signs the ballot. Those things take a certain degree of time to reconcile.
So if you didn't have the ballots from other counties problem, how much time does it take?
It's a minor part of the whole. The process is really all of the processes of reconciling, of checking the ballots that are challenged. Even when we did poll elections and we had fail-safe ballots, we had to validate that those people are registered and that they're indeed qualified to vote before we could even count those ballots. And there was always a great deal of those as well. So whether you do a poll election or you did a mail election, you're still resolving issues that don't fall, because people don't always do quite what they're supposed to do. And that takes time to reconcile. And to do it quickly, you might miss something and not do it accurately.
The other thing that has to happen after election night, there's an election night tally, and then the county will begin to look at those provisional ballots, replacement ballots, people who have updated since perhaps their first ballot was mailed to them, and to make sure that they haven't already voted. And in some cases, that's conferring with the county from which they moved, that within that 18 to 14 days before the election, when the ballots were mailed in all counties, to make sure that they hadn't voted that first county ballot.
What do they do differently in Washington State from what we do that allows them to do this?
Almost.
Well, actually, they have as much or more of a problem in tallying votes. And actually, our elections director, John Lindbeck, talked to the Washington, just previously passed Washington State elections director, and he's happy to talk to you about Washington's concerns about a September time.
Mr. Chair, am I going over things that Senator Atkinson has already gone over?
Well, let me, I do want to get to the alternative when we...
Yeah. Washington has, I was just informed, also has 28 days to for the counties to certify their results to them.
Senator Menace.
Could we just move this bill and then let them sort it out on the House side?
No.
It's starting to remind me of the Revenue Committee. That's
yeah.
Well,
it's not clean like criminal law. Yeah.
Mr.
Yeah.
Chair?
Yeah, Senator Atkinson.
Again, when we heard this issue the first time, we went out, this work group did came up with the first version right here, which was really, really great work. And again, I don't, with how difficult technical this thing is, that's why I wanted to come here before I proceeded. Whatever the chair would like to do, but if you'd like maybe some members to get together and work through this at a non-committee time, I don't know if that's possible. I realize I'm now pushing a very big rock up a very steep hill, but whatever your wishes are.
Let's go through very quickly the
right.
What might... Yeah, we'll be brief.
This next timeline represents how these dates might be less of an obstacle to a successful conducting of both the primary and general, and that's the third Tuesday in August. What this proposal does, even though it still contains some enormous risks, because it's expecting an awful lot of things to fall into place on time and correctly, even while there's mucho multitasking going on both at the state and local level. So you're going to run that risk with this, but it does allow you to maintain the November general election for initiative measures, something you may choose not to do because that's one of the worst overburdens, if you will, on tasks at the state and local level to even carry out a successful primary election. You would be able to have separate voters pamphlets for the primary and the general. We don't understand Washington to even have a primary election voters pamphlet. They only have a general election voters pamphlet. And they do not have the same initiative referendum process or schedule, so they don't get let all of them piled up at one election for, you know, a major the event on the initiative calendar. This proposal allows us to add three more days to that 40-day under the bill window for mailing military ballots, which we've been out of the country ballots. We think that's very important. The National Voter Assistance Program doesn't have a act of Congress or a regulation to back them up on their advisory date of no less than 45 days. And so, as we said earlier, we're running some risk by even cutting it down by 2 days, but we think that that's far of a less risk than 40 days. Retains the mailing window between the 18th and 14th day before an election. And it retains those dates for certifying results. What would have to be unique to the primary election only to make even the third Tuesday in August work is that on the ninth day after the election, the counties would, by 9 a.m., tell us what their vote tallies were as of that date. So they just run a report and get it to us either overnight or first thing that morning. That would give us the opportunity to declare automatic recounts. This is so that can, based on the unofficial results, and so that we could start that right away. Again, this is much like Florida, that started start automatic recounts within 24 hours of that initial election night tally that doesn't include military or other county ballots. So at least we're giving you a week there, and so there's more information on which to trigger an automatic recount, rather than waiting, as we'd have to under a September primary, till 30 days after. A demand recount would have to be also filed by then, based on those results, and because there's no time to do a 5%, 10%, and then possibly 100%. Those demand recounts would all have to be for 100%. And, of course, the person making the demand would have to put down the appropriate deposit. Those recounts would have to begin on the 20th day and be completed by the 22nd day. Unfortunately, even under this time frame, there is no means to contest the results of the primary election. This would foreclose even the situation in Senate District 29, the Democratic nominating primary in the 2000 election, where there was a material error in the ballots in one of the several counties in that district, and where the clerk then asked for a contest of the election. So you just have to, I guess, pray that there weren't material errors in the printing or distribution of the ballots or tally as to change the outcome of a primary nomination. And, of course, that's okay. Enough said. And, and in this case, the county clerks were shaved off 3 days from the 20 days. So that we get a summary of official results so that we can prepare and certify the state ballot sooner, and then the detailed certification of all official results from the counties would still be the 20th day. So that's demonstrated up here, and you'll see that there aren't as many conflicts, really, if any. The biggest concern in this scenario as well is signature verification, because you're still, and actually, yeah, you still put the burden on the counties to prepare and conduct a primary election, because at the same time they're doing signature verification. So our if you were inclined to proceed, we would prefer that you went with the first Tuesday in August, and that would resolve any of these overlaps. We would advise you to move the initiative and referendum process to some other election, either what is now the May primary date in an even-numbered year, or to the November date in an odd-numbered year. Or you could have it in May while you're in session. but those, again, are our recommendations, and this is the product of work of many county clerks. I want to thank Annette, especially Vicki Irvin as well, of Multnomah County, and the Elections Division staff and Legislative Council.
Yes, that's good work, a lot of effort. But where are you, Senator Atkinson?
My interest level is still real high. I think there's one other element, though, that I'd like to have direction from the committee before I go start drafting, or have LC draft, and that is what Fred was talking about at the very end. Do you just put initiatives on one on the May ballot?
For the primary.
No.
It's not a
question. Move everything to the general election?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, we met with legislative council and agree with them that the although the Constitution says it's the general election or such other date as the legislature determines, so if you statutorily determine that they all were on some other date, and then the signature filing deadline is 4 months before the election in which the petition would be voted on.
If you move it to the primary, you'd take care of a lot of your workload issues. Yeah. What do you guys want to do, John? You want to press ahead?
Mr. Chair, I know you're concerned that I don't ever provide my opinion enough, but on this issue...
That has been bothering me quite a bit.
I do. Yeah. I think for me, the two issues about moving the... I like the concept, but the two issues for me are voter participation and cost of the election in terms of campaign finance reform. And in talking to folks in the last several weeks, it's clear to me that if we move our primary to August, not only will anybody vote, I mean, nobody's going to be even there to receive their voter's pamphlet. And secondly, I don't think it reduces the cost of the campaign. It may slightly, but I don't think it has a huge impact. So
But again, I'm used to being
overruled.
Mm-hmm. Lee, where are you on this thing? First, let's see what we get. Andy?
September.
August 20th.
We can do it.
Okay. You know what you want. Mm-hmm. You got the feel for that. That's a pretty big rock, and I don't want to put the labor out unless we think we're going to be somewhat successful.
How do they do it in other states?
Mm-hmm.
I was there, but I
didn't
get the daylight speed out of
you. Senator Brown, are you beating on Senator Courtney?
Among other things.
No.
She's made sure she's taking her shots.
Yeah. Okay, well.
Hitting the kidney blows, huh?
Every hour.
Can we talk to somebody in Washington?
Yes.
John? Can we just hear from him briefly?
Sure.
1 or 2 minutes?
Sure.
How much is that, the Huskies?
That's the state they're of.
For the record, I'm John Lindbeck, Director of Elections. The last time this bill was heard in committee, and as a result of our meeting with Senator Atkinson, it was a follow-up meeting to that. I did call Gary McIntosh, the Director of Elections in Washington, and asked him what the situation was with their primary. And yes, they do have a September primary. They want to move theirs back to May and have been trying to do that for several years, but have run into some obstacles with their campaign finance law and their annual sessions and their ability to raise money during a legislative session and then having a primary right after that. They, according to Mr. McIntosh, are very unhappy with the September primary, mainly because, well, there are two reasons. One of the principal reasons was sort of touched on in the earlier testimony. When you compress the time between your primary election and your general election, and if you end up in a very close race in a primary, that it takes time to straighten that out. Sometimes the recounts take 2 weeks, 3 weeks, and if somebody goes to court, it takes even longer. And they have had several races like that in Washington. And it has resulted in one party being given what was viewed as an unfair advantage. They didn't go through that struggle. The other party was out there in the race with the ability to organize, campaign, raise money, while the other campaign was taking weeks to get through this mess.
Political parties?
Yes, political parties.
I think you mean the candidate.
The party whose nominee is not known because of the recount or contest situation has no means of, they don't know who their candidate is, and so you have both of those candidates out trying to raise money or campaigning?
The party that has the close primary ends up in a disadvantage, and with the two elections so close together, it sort of magnifies the size of that disadvantage, and they've had this they've had this problem there, and it's one of the reasons that was cited to me as why they want to move back to May.
Do you have a feel for what the people think of their primary, about moving it or leaving it?
Well, the way it was represented to me was that the legislature, there was a prevailing feeling among the legislature that they would really like to move it back from September. And he gave me bill numbers, and there are various bills before the legislature now to do that. Now, he was part of a task force that involved chairs of all their caucuses in the legislature, and they made recommendations to move it back. They have one bill to move it back to May. They have other bills to move it back to other dates, because that May date conflicts.
Okay.
With their annual session.
Well, that's I appreciate the efforts going into it. Jason and I'll talk here when we get done. See if we can't figure out something that makes sense. You know, I don't want to do anything stupid, but I appreciate everything you guys have done. It's really good.
Thank you.
Thanks.
It was good.
Well, that will close the public hearing on 752. Bruce, are you ready to go? Let's open the work session on Senate Bill 960.
Thank you. Yes, sir, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, members, just before you start, Bruce, you should have the staff measure summary and the dash one amendments.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, an attorney with Harangal and Gary Rudnick, and a member of the Capital Club Board of Directors, here in support of Senate Bill 960 and the dash one amendments. When we talked to you about this last week, you asked that we meet with Pat Hearn of the Government Standards and Practices Commission to discuss their concerns. Following that meeting, the Government Standards and Practices Commission met last Friday. Mr. Hearn called me and communicated specific issues that the commission had identified of concern to them with the proposed bill. And we have made further modifications to the bill, I believe, to accommodate those concerns. Unfortunately, Mr. Hearn has been on vacation this week, so I have not had the opportunity to discuss these amendments directly with him. But based on our conversations, it's my impression that these changes should be acceptable. And I would be glad to discuss specifically the dash one amendments with the committee if that's your preference. Or to answer any questions you may have.
Senator Minnis.
Well, with respect to the dash one amendments, when Mr. Hearn was here, he raised the issue on page 1, line 28, under the definition of lobbying, that it did not include executive branch. And if you turn over to page 2, line 15, where it talks about maintaining integrity and so on and so forth, there are amendments. It includes the executive branch. So I think he raised the issue that he felt that executive branch should be included in that definition of lobbying. Was there a reason that it was not in the dash one amendment, that change wasn't included?
Mr. Chair, we didn't propose to expand the scope of the definition of lobbying.
But let me just, I guess, follow up on that. I mean, isn't that what Section 2 of the bill is really getting to?
Section 2 is a general in purpose statement in the law, I believe.
And the general purpose statement, in fact, existing language includes executive branch.
It does. And we haven't made any changes in that regard as to either the general purpose or the definition of lobbying.
But I think Mr. Hearn's right that by definition, if you exclude executive branch, aren't you? I mean, you're talking about them in terms of the general purpose, but yet you're excluding them in the definition of lobbying. Seems inconsistent to me.
That's not an issue that we've addressed, Senator. And he didn't recommunicate that to us as a concern following the commission's meeting on Friday.
You okay with that?
Well, I think that Mr. Hearn is correct. I do think that the executive branch should be included in that definition. I'll defer to the chair in terms of what you want to do with the bill, but they can always pick that up on the House side, too, and get the Senate bill. So.
Yeah, there's one other issue. You're still on dueling dates on the registration. Is that what I understand?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. We had originally proposed that lobbyist registrations not terminate at all. Currently, they terminate 2 years after the registration was made. Mr. Hearn and the commission objected to that because they were concerned that outdated registrations would clutter their files, and they wanted the two-year termination. They proposed as an alternative that all registrations terminate on June 30th of even-numbered years. And the concern that we had with that proposal was that that would throw it into the off-session years when nobody was probably going to pay attention to their lobbyist registrations. So we countered with the proposal to terminate all registrations December 31st of odd-numbered years at the end of the session year. And in that way, we will conform to the expenditure reporting requirements for both lobbyists and lobbying interests who have to make annual expenditure reports. So we've tried to put those two together in a way that satisfies both our interests in having some consistency and the commission's in terms of being able to administer that plan. So we believe now that the December 31 termination of registrations with a grace period, if it's extended in the off year, is an acceptable solution.
A yes or no would have been more than sufficient.
Thanks, Randy.
Okay. I think I'm let's get this thing moving. I think we got enough to get it going here.
Giddy up.
Are we in work session? Yeah.
Sherrod moves the Dash 1 amendment.
Senator Brown moves the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 960. Any further discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move the bill to the floor as amended with due pass recommendation.
Senator Brown moves Senate Bill 960 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any other discussion? Hearing none, so ordered.
It is.
Thank you.
Okay. Did you say you're carried, Senator Atkinson? Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Is that what I said? I thought I was talking to the Senator.
Mr. Chair, as the only person on this committee who's ever been a member of the Capitol Club, I would be happy to carry.
We'd be delighted also. Senator Atkinson would be delighted. Yes, thank you very much.
That's a little historical. No,
no, no kidding.
Really? Who were you?
Who?
When I first started.
Yeah. Wow.
I think I was beating up on you, wasn't I?
Boom. Yeah.
Nothing's changed.
Boom. Anybody here for Senate? Anybody here for Senate Bill 620? By any chance? The bill is sponsored Senator Byron here, so we will not get to that today, as long as nobody cares. And we'll open up a public hearing on SJR 41. Okay, just for the committee, for the audience, what we have here. It's kind of what I'd like to see is a process improvement, hopefully a process improvement on the whole initiative business. But we would like to encourage petitioners to bring their ideas to the legislature, let the legislature work on them as best they can and do with them what they can do. So we would like to open up the Offices of Legislative Counsel to these ideas so they go through that process. The same way we do. We'd like to open up the public hearing process, make it available. I think that's something that would probably enhance the whole system if we could get people to participate. So that's what this is today. I have no intention of doing anything other than doing that today, unless you guys give me 7 thumbs up. But but that's what we're trying to do, just trying to make this a little bit better. So. We have some testimony here. Mr. Sizemore, would you like to talk or you just want to get started? Okay, all right. Then we'll just go in order then. Chuck McLaren. And Michelle Deister.
Good afternoon, Senator.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Michelle Deister with the League of Oregon Cities. In light of what you have just said, basically I prepared my comments today as a reflection on the merits of Senate Joint Resolution 41. Are you interested in hearing that today?
Yeah, we are. That's what we're trying to get out.
Okay.
Get it on the record,
okay.
You know, what people are thinking.
Thank you very much.
That would be useful.
Okay. So. As I said, I'm Michelle Deister from the League of Oregon Cities, and I would, first of all, like to emphasize that senior citizens are a very integral part of every community. The contributions of older Oregonians have helped to shape the history and the livability and the viability of every neighborhood, city, and region in this state. Their contributions to their communities have been and continue to be vital, and we would submit that the very idea of a community consists of each individual contributing to the extent of their ability for the benefit of all the members of that community. SJR 41, as you know, would phase in an exemption from the permanent rate of property taxes for senior citizens beginning in 2003. The League of Oregon Cities is very concerned about the revenue impacts associated with this proposal and how it would affect cities' ability to provide services to city residents regardless of their age if it were passed by voters as an amendment to the Constitution. an analysis of this proposal estimates that if it were passed by voters, this could result in a revenue impact of approximately $910 million per biennium if you adjust it to exclude the provision that requires rental assistance. Of that amount, we estimate that approximately $204 million would be a revenue impact to Oregon cities. Because of that potential for the large revenue impacts, we would ask that this committee subsequently refer this proposal, if appropriate, to the Senate Revenue Committee. I would add that it's important to note that property taxes support services to property and to the residents that occupy that property. Examples of those services include water, sewer, roads, and public safety. And we feel it's appropriate that residents who consume these services contribute toward the cost of them. There is no denying that there are many economically disadvantaged senior citizens. We acknowledge that. There are existing state and federal programs that may provide some relief. For instance, the Department of Revenue has the Senior Homestead Property Tax Deferral Program for seniors who qualify. And the Senior and Disabled Services Division has a number of programs that allow seniors to remain independent and in their homes. These services to senior citizens complement local government's ability to provide services to all residents. SJR 41 contains no income restrictions for the beneficiaries, and also of particular concern is the fact that there are no residency requirements prior to receipt of the property tax exemption. The communities that seniors have given a lifetime of service to may not even be in Oregon under this scenario. It's conceivable that this bill could result in in-migration of senior citizens, increased consumption of local services, and no way to pay for them. So with that, I would like to turn this over to Mayor McLaren.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mayor. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and Senators. It's a pleasure to be here to speak to you. As Mayor of Albany, I am 67 years old, so that puts me into the group of what is known as senior citizens. And I know that I and certain other members of my community would benefit from this bill. However, I want to tell you the economic impacts that this would have on the city of Albany if it were passed in its present form and went into full effect. Right now, we are in our budget meetings for the forthcoming year, and our general fund taxes income for this next year is $8,895,800. That is all that we get into the general fund from property taxes. The police and fire budgets of our city total $9,922,400, which is a difference of $1,026,600. Franchise fees are the second largest income to the general fund, and they run right now around $2.4 million. So that difference is made up from those franchise fees. However, other programs in the city are well constrained, and we are having a very great discussion right now as to who gets funded. Do we maintain level of services at the library, at the senior center, at Parks and Rec, and so forth? The population of the city of Albany is 40,852, according to this latest count. About 14% of our population are senior citizens over the age of 65. Now, everyone in Albany gets the services of the fire and the police. They use the parks and recreation, they use a library, and they use the senior center. The fact is that if the senior citizens in Albany were placed into the position of being exempt from property taxes, it is estimated that we would lose $2.2 million to our general fund. That means that we would start the budget year out $3.2 million below what the property taxes for our general fund come in and to pay for just the fire and police, the basic safety and health services. That would put a tremendous strain on our budget, which would mean that we would probably have to close the library. We would probably have to close the senior center, which is a very great asset to the senior citizens of Albany. We had last year close to 11,000 people visit the senior center. Now, these are, of course, the same ones every day, but I mean, over the year, it's 11,000 people walk through the door. Our Albany Fire Department handles the ambulance calls, and approximately 54% of those ambulance calls are Medicare patients. Right now, that is a self-sufficient service, and it's paying for itself. However, there have been some federal changes in Medicare reimbursements, and this year, our loss is expected at $184,000. That has to be made up from the general fund. If the law does not change, that loss is going to get greater over the next few years, putting more of a strain on our general fund dollars. Another example, as I mentioned, about the senior center. The senior center provides recreation, crafts, meals. We have a meal there every day for seniors who are in need. We have the call-a-ride transportation, and we also offer trips and excursions for the seniors who do not own cars and just want to get out and enjoy Oregon from the coast to Portland and elsewhere. We have trips to Portland. We have trips to Ashland and to the coast and elsewhere. We also have one half of one community policing specialist job that works with seniors. We do home safety inspections. We help them install deadbolts if they need it. We make sure they have smoke detectors through both the fire department and the police department. And we also give them classes on personal hazards and how to be aware of scam artists and what they can do to protect themselves. Now, as Ms. Deister said, there is already a senior deferral program in place. And I feel that is something that does help low-income seniors. But this bill would devastate the economic budget of the city of Albany, and I'm sure that other cities could have the same type of statements to make about their general fund.
Good. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Both of you. Questions?
In your testimony, you'd mentioned that there wasn't any residency requirement in this proposal.
I didn't believe that there was a residency requirement in SJR 41.
What would you suggest be the residency requirement?
Well, seeing, I guess that I would certainly leave that as a policy decision, but I think that there should be one, perhaps maybe 5 years or some sort of recognition that the folks who are living in this community have been contributing over a period of time.
And I think you also mentioned no income test. Did you have some guidance on that?
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think the point that I was trying to make is that
there are several existing programs. For instance, the senior homestead property tax deferral program, which are need-based. And as I said, there are very many economically disadvantaged senior citizens, and we recognize that. However, I think there is also some percentage of senior citizens who may be able to contribute a portion of their property tax to fund services that they consume, such as those pointed out by Mayor McLaren.
The, if I might, just one, let me ask the mayor this question. I take it from your testimony you're not too excited about this.
No, sir, I'm not.
That shows you I was listening. What I do want to ask you, though, is how do you think this would fare on the ballot in your city or throughout Oregon?
In my city, I'm not sure that it would particularly pass, because we do have a public-spirited population. We also have a large number of seniors who own their own homes outright, and they don't pay mortgages, and they are not opposed to paying their fair share.
Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mayor McLaren, good to see you. My question is this. Why not go to a user pay system for your city so that folks pay to use the senior services center, that folks pay to use fire and police, that kind of system? Why not go that route?
We are exploring those. As of this year, we are setting up some work sessions to explore a transportation district, to explore a police levy. We are looking at other areas to do that. It is not something that we have shunned. It's just that we have been placed into the corner now where we have to look at that.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Rich, Lori, and David Williams. And if all three of you could come up.
How you doing?
Good. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rich Peppers. I'm representing the Service Employees International Union, Local 503, OPEU. We represent a lot of the a lot of state workers, frontline workers, and also a fair number of local government employees, no school employees. And the testimony I have to provide are concerns about this proposal, many of which are not very different from what you've already heard raised as concerns in previous testimony, but let me go through them anyway. First of all, the concern we have is, of course, around the revenue impact of this bill, should it be implemented. And you heard a figure of a total impact of $900 million plus per year. I'm sorry, per biennium, I think that figure was. That's a huge impact, and you had it broken down by one city, one community, in terms of how it relates to the actual services that community tries to provide with to its seniors and also others in the community. That's one concern. The other is that in this bill there is no means test or it's not set up to work according to the need in terms of income. And there are, for people at low income, in low income ranges, there are existing programs that are targeted at them. That's not to say those can't be improved upon, but we would argue that the focus should be on that as opposed to an across-the-board exemption. And the third is more of a conceptual concern or discussion, which is that there's the fairness issues, and we think that it's absolutely true that that seniors are a valuable part of communities, but they also do use services in the community, and you had testimony on that earlier too, ranging from police to public transportation, parks, libraries, fire protection, senior centers, and a whole host of other services that were mentioned before. it seems fair that if seniors do have the income to be able to afford to pay their share of taxes for this, property taxes, that might be one way to, that might be fair to expect. And similarly, it's also not the only place to deal with low-income seniors. There are, through the income tax system and refundable income tax credits, there are ways to perhaps get at the issue. And finally, seniors, just back to the fairness issue, seniors were once school kids too, and other seniors helped put them through schools. It seems only reasonable and fair to expect that they, as part of an overall community, would extend the courtesy to the next generations coming up, many of whom are their own grandkids, and definitely tied into their families and their communities. That's my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Rich.
Do you have more questions?
It's up to you. Okay. Yeah. Save you in the middle.
Sure, we'll go a little bit out of order.
Put that rose in between you two thorns.
I have to shield her from. Yeah. I am the rose. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Williams. I'm here representing the Oregon School Employees Association. We represent approximately 19,000 school employees in Oregon's K-12, Head Start, Parks and Rec, ESD, and community college districts in the state. We believe that SGR 41 is bad tax policy. Here in Oregon, everyone benefits from the vast services that are funded by our tax system by both income and property taxes, and therefore everyone, to the extent that they have the ability to, should pay into that system for the benefit of society, both current and future generations. We further believe that this piece of legislation also continues to shrink the tax base for Oregon, thereby shifting the burden onto a smaller and smaller number of individuals in the state. Not to mention that this bill, as Rich mentioned, is enormously expensive and would, in the end, conceivably end up cutting many of the services that our seniors rely on. Police, fire, even schools. Seniors don't necessarily rely on schools. However, I think we all can understand here the benefit of schools in our society. And we see the inevitability of the dollars cut from this, especially on the local level, that many of these services are funded through those avenues. And OSCA, again, cannot support SGR 41 in any form and would urge you all to vote no on the bill.
Thanks.
Good afternoon.
Are you going to read your testimony here?
No, I won't.
Well, I want to read a little piece. This is cool. Knowing in advance that the train is coming doesn't make the crash hurt less once one is hit.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Lori Wimmer Whalen, representing Oregon Education Association and its 45,000 members who are teachers, classified employees, and community college faculty throughout Oregon. And we too are here, as you may not be surprised to discover, in opposition to SJR 41 for many of the reasons. I see that. And thank you for your reading of my one of my favorite lines in my testimony as well. We have many of the same concerns that you've already heard, so let me just summarize quickly because you do have my written testimony. Point one, ever since the passage of Measure 5, we have increasingly depended upon the state general fund to the point of 70% of the total revenue for schools for support for those vital core services that Oregonians have told us over and over again in polls that they treasure and that they depend on to be funded adequately. We believe that this only exacerbates that problem by further reducing the local revenue effort, and I would point out to you in the text of this measure, local option taxes passed by your colleagues last session and reaffirmed by the voters at the ballot in 2000 explicitly is targeted, and we think that that is would be a shame because that particular piece was an intent to reinvigorate the local effort with respect to school funding. And that's something that we think is very important because local communities connect with their local schools and believe that they want to have local control, and given that money follows the power base, the less and less local communities are able to participate in that, the more is lost, I think, in the long run with respect to education policy. We also believe, as others have said, that because it shrinks the tax base and also fails the fairness test with respect to means testing, that this is an experiment we cannot afford and that is not a fair thing to do. We also are very concerned that for every tax dollar levied by state and local governments, we are already giving 54 cents of it away in tax breaks of one sort or another. And that means 46 cents are left over to fund all vital programs, whether at the state or local level. And I just wonder at what point we're going to say, enough. Some may argue that impact is lessened, as I said, by the phase-in. I'm noticing that more and more frequently in various proposals, both in this building and outside of it, as a way to make the impact have a softer landing, some say. But the landing is still the landing, and if the cut is a cut, that means there are fewer dollars on the table. And I will remind you that in this building and at the ballot box, the barriers to increasing or devising new revenue streams are becoming politically more and more impossible. It takes 50% plus one to send a measure out of this building to cut taxes. It takes significantly more than that, 3/5 of each house and a supermajority at the ballot, except during general elections, to create new revenue streams. And so that makes it very tough to do a responsible job of funding government programs that Oregonians care about and depend on. Now, we also have some questions about mechanically how some pieces of it would function, as I've mentioned under the overreaching mandate piece. The constitutionalizing of a directive to the future legislative assemblies to enact rent relief commensurate with the relief that's given in this property tax cut, I'm not quite sure how that mechanically would even be done. Or how it would be calculated, but that was something I thought I'd draw your attention to because it seems to be a problem with the bill. And I also would finally point out that the remedy is redundant. We have two options right now for seniors who are finding themselves upon retirement needing to downside their economic burdens per month. One is to downsize their home. I mean, if they are empty nesters finally and upon retirement decide they want a lower level of outgo each month, they can choose to sell their primary residence and buy down. And if they're over age 65, I think there's a capital gains exception for them one time. Or if they choose to stay in that home, they can, of course, as you've heard before, defer that either until there's a difference in their income level upward, or they can defer it all the way to the end and make it a part of the burden of the estate upon their demise. So I think that previous legislatures have already addressed this problem of those low-income seniors who may be in danger of foreclosure by offering those two kinds of flexible and, I think, meaningful remedies. And so this is sort of a solution in search of a problem. With that, I will say we do believe in comprehensive tax reform. We have tests inside our own organization of evaluating tax policy based on fairness, adequacy, and stability. And we are certainly willing to be partners at the table, whatever table, to create a tax system that is both fair and adequate and stable. We just don't see that carve-outs such as this achieve that. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Brown.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I guess the question I'll just take you on, Rich, and that is,
Thank you.
Terms of means testing, what are you talking about? What do you think is a reasonable level? Would it depend upon the revenue that's being cut? Just give me a sense.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown. I can't give you a figure response. What I can say is that the approach I would take is to build on the existing programs for tax deferral and look at whether those are meeting the need in specific communities to see if there is a shortfall or not for what is happening across the state. I would probably not try to adopt a one-size-fits-all approach across all communities, but that's a policy decision. But I would say look at the specifics and build on what you already have in place.
Okay, thanks.
Senator Miller.
More in reading, like Senator Harper did, I went a little to a couple other lines in here, but let me talk about the remedies you propose to somebody who's having a hard time paying property tax. I mean, do you find either one of those satisfactory to somebody who's, I guess, at least according to your testimony, you've got two basic options, either leave your house or choose deferral? I mean, do you think that's satisfactory to somebody in that situation?
Mr. Chair and Senator Miller, I think that there are any number of strategies any family or household has to achieve economic well-being and to balance their budgets, and it wouldn't be proper for me to evaluate whether any one particular strategy is the best for any family. I can tell you that I think the legislatures have tried to offer remedies for those who are that close to the margin, and to the extent that we certainly have plenty of unsolved problems out there with respect to hunger and housing and various other issues for folks who really are at the margins. I'm not certain that we as a society do provide all the remedies that one would in the ideal world do. But here we are in a revenue cutting situation with a big giant hole in the state budget as it is, trying to provide as many services as the state is able to for those folks close to the margin. It just doesn't make any sense from my perspective and from that of my organization to further cut when we're already in that budget balancing squeeze. I recognize that maybe folks have an emotional attachment to, for example, a family home, but the deferral option has been a solution for many of them.
Having talked with some people who've been forced to use that, I can tell you they don't enjoy it. They would prefer to be able to pay their taxes and not have this show up at some later time in their estate as an obligation. And I think it misses the mark, in my view, all of this remedy discussion about the burden of high property taxes on people who are having a hard time.
Mr. Chair and Senator Miller, if I could just add also on to that, it would be important, I think, in this connection to look at the big picture of all tax, the entire tax system, and there are for low-income citizens some targeted income tax-related opportunities too. Not that those would necessarily address the whole issue for people, and I agree, where there is a problem and people stand to lose their homes, that's something that needs to be addressed. I don't think that any of us are saying that it shouldn't be addressed, but I don't think this does that alone.
The other question I had, Mr. Chair, is almost apologetic to ask it of Lori, because she knows I'm on the Education Subcommittee of Ways and Means, but in one of your paragraphs here, you said this measure, for instance, specifically targets the newly passed local option levies granted by the 99 legislature, and specifically then reaffirmed in ballot measure 1 by the voters in the 2000 election cycle. Then you say, clearly it was not the intent of the voters or your colleagues to chip away at this new revenue source. Were you referring not to ballot measure 1? Because if it's ballot measure 1, I'm not aware of the funding source.
Oh, Mr. Chair and Senator Miller, ballot measure 1 did talk in part, had a two-part, one part of it was the accountability language, but the other part was a power-equalized model for the local option law that had just been passed in 99.
Which model?
It's, well, we call it power equalization. It's a way to more equally distribute the capacity to pass a local option.
Okay.
That was part of the language of Measure 1, which passed.
You were saying ballot Measure 1 had money in it.
No.
Thank you.
Senator Brown.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I guess, and I don't know that any of you would have the answer to this, and I'm looking at the fairness issue and thinking of my particular family situation. I guess my question is, are there similar property tax deferrals or abilities that families who are living on the edge can access so they don't lose their homes? And I'm talking about single parents with children. I'm talking about a lot of Oregon families that are out there that are really having a hard time making ends meet, and A, can't or in a home, or B, can't hang on to even get into a home. So what are available for other Oregonians that are in big time trouble, that have children?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, I'm not aware of specific targeted property tax relief of that sort. There may be some, but I'm not aware.
Okay.
Senator Beyer.
Just to point Senator Miller's comment a minute ago, the testimony, Lori's testimony talks about, I think, local option levies, but I'm reading it right, 41 specifically exempts local option property tax.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Some odd things would still be taxed. The local options would still be included.
Okay.
The commissioner is still reading the bills.
Line 14.
Look, he's still on
line 20, Lori.
Oh, okay. As Emily Latella said, never mind. And who?
You got me.
Saturday.
All right, thank you.
Jim Davis, Bob Porter.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Jim Davis. And representing today the Oregon State Council of Senior Citizens, United Seniors, Gray Panthers, the Oregon Coalition of Seniors and People with Disabilities. We are here to express our strong opposition to SJR 41, which would incrementally eliminate property taxes paid by anybody over the age of 65. We also would plan to strongly oppose the ballot initiative if it did make it to the ballot. On the surface, this sounds like a great idea for our senior community. But when you do a little digging, you realize how irresponsible SJR 41 would be, not only to the population that it purports to serve, but also to Oregon citizens of all ages. Once fully implemented, as we have heard today, there will be significant loss to our schools of around $190 million a year and to local governments of around $325 million a year. If we think we have a budget crisis now, we can only imagine what we would face if this measure passed. The significant lost revenues that would occur because of this measure would affect key state and local services for our populations and for other populations as well, from young to old. Seniors depend on local senior and disability services that would face drastic cuts, and they also depend on essential governmental services like fire and police. State-funded community-based long-term care services would surely face another round of cuts that would make our battle this session seem like nothing, leading again to the even more depleted services and loss of even more federal matching funds. We feel that citizens of all ages have a responsibility and a commitment to the funding of our vital educational as well as social services here in the state, and the seniors want to make their societal contribution as well. Certainly there needs to be assistance to lower and middle income homeowners to keep them from being taxed out of their homes. This is being currently accomplished quite well for lower and lower middle income seniors through the tax deferral program. That program is helping the seniors that need that help the most, and not upper income older Oregonians whose need for such a tax break is not worth risking the quality of our educational and social service systems. We would, however, be supportive of further property tax benefits to lower and middle income individuals. This measure simply goes too far and doesn't adequately target those who need the assistance the most. It is not a responsible means of dealing with property tax relief for seniors. It would benefit upper income seniors while forcing drastic cuts in schools and safety and social services that would negatively affect our local communities. We urge you to oppose this measure.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senators, and my name is Bob Porter. I'm the Vice President of the United Seniors of Oregon, and I'm on the Executive Board of the Oregon State Council of Senior Citizens. Like the honored mayor of Albany, I'm also 67 years old, And at first glance, this, you know, Jim showed me this. I said, this looks like a, you know, really good deal. and then I started reading a little bit about it. You know, on January 16th, we had a rally here, Save Our Seniors, and we had 500 people, you know, and Governor Kitzhaber came out and said, you know, ordinarily I've got some red meat to throw to a crowd like this, but he said this time there's nothing. And he went back inside this warm building, but I'm happy to say we had a couple of distinguished senators here who didn't mind braving the cold and coming out and pledging support to try and refund Oregon Project Independence and these other cuts. I'm diametrically opposed to this. Also, like the mayor, I'm happy and feel privileged to pay my fair share, as long as the people that need it, particularly senior citizens, are getting the support and the services they need. It seems like my wife behind me is second vice president of the Oregon State Council and a lobbyist, and it seems like we're spending half our life coming here right now to try to refund these things that have been cut. If there was no red meat now, if this thing goes through, there won't be even any bones to throw to the crowd. Thank you very much.
Senator Menes.
A question with respect to the position. Have you done any research, the constituent group? In other words, have you done any polling of the senior groups and asked them about these ideas to find out how they might receive it if it became a ballot measure or if it was presented to them? Because obviously you're well informed and you know what's going on here, but I'm thinking about the population of seniors growing in the state of Oregon and how they would receive this kind of a message.
Well, Senator Menes and Mr. Chair, no, we haven't done any polling. It's just only recently that we found out about this, that this resolution was seriously moving through the process, so we haven't had that opportunity. I do know that the people that we represent would not be supportive of this because they would realize the serious repercussions of supporting this measure and the impact that it would have on services. In terms of the overall senior population, I think at first glance you'd say, oh gee, this is great, we're going to have some property tax benefits and this is a great service to us, but I think once we would get out there and educate the senior population in the state of the impact that this would have, I would question whether the majority of seniors would support this measure.
Thank you
very much. Gil. And Hasina?
Yes, I'll be right back.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, in absentia, members of the committee, Gil Riddell, Association.
It's now Madam Chair.
Oh, good. I know the vice chair wasn't anything.
Oh, all right.
He did.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. I'm going to try to avoid repetition, just point out a couple of things with respect to my written comments. It appears that the impact of this on county services would be to the tune of about $180 million a biennium. And this figure would threaten essential county services that seniors and others rely on, public safety, including law enforcement, prosecution and corrections, public health services, mental health services, and local senior services. No less significant, this resolution would reduce the state-funded school system by over $300 million a biennium. Most Oregonians would see no benefit from the enactment of SJR 41 and would pay for it by fewer services. The resolution shoots at the wrong target. The property tax system has been rolled back, cut, and capped. Income tax collections now exceed the local property tax collections by $4.7 billion a year to $2.8 billion a year. Nevertheless, the property tax is still a major source of local revenues. If this resolution were amended to address need, the better instrument to measure the need would be income, and the better instrument to meet the need would be the income tax revenues. I'd point out, too, the last session, the legislature set forth state policy in granting new exemptions. In summary, these statutes provide that new exemptions granted by the state are paid by local governments and have adverse consequences, and that new exemptions, therefore, should be funded at least to the tune of 50% by the state.
Mr. Chair, I have a question about that. Would that apply to ballot measures as well?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, I'm not entirely sure.
If we were to pass it out as a referral, would, under those circumstances, would we still be required to pay 50% of the exemption?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown,
I would
argue that, but I should tell you that the payments come out of a fund that was created by the law last session, and the fund is now has $1 in it.
Okay.
So as a practical matter, this is a moral obligation and not a financial obligation at this point. At some point, we'd like to see this really function, because I think that the policy is good.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, SJR 41 makes a complex property tax system even more confusing to both the folks who have to administer it and the taxpayers. And just for your information, counties spend about $130 million locally a biennium to administer the property tax system. That concludes my remarks.
Can I ask them one more question? Yeah. Why not means test this?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, I note in the written material that that would seem to make more sense. But I wouldn't be able to offer any help in terms at this point in terms of specific income standards or anything.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Hussein Squires on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon. I'll be very brief since my colleagues have made many of the comments that we would echo regarding this measure. One thing that I would like to point out that's a little different for special purpose local governments, the special districts, typically a special district is solely funded through property tax revenue. We do not receive state shared revenue from the state, for example, as cities and counties do with liquor and cigarette taxes. Some special districts function solely on a fee-based service, and it really varies. Typically, it's the infrastructure types of districts, water, sewer, that function with mainly just fees, not property taxes. Having said that, rural fire protection districts mainly function through the property tax revenue. And so losses in property tax revenues for special districts typically, specifically rural fire protection district types of districts or hospital districts, which seniors tend to take more, tend to use those types of services more often. Those declining property tax revenues for a special service district, unlike a city or a county, we don't have the ability to say, well, this means we're not going to fund the senior center or we're not going to fund the library. It means the fire district is going to operate with less money unless it raises additional revenue. So that's just a difference that I'd like to point out.
Senator Beyer.
Mr. Hussein, do fire districts, I'm thinking primarily of them, but it may apply to others, do they have the ability to switch off of property taxes onto assessments?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I'm not aware of the ability of a fire district to do that. I know fire districts have the ability to establish different tax zones, but those are property tax zones with differing levels of service.
I know the property tax, you can't do that, but you could assess a set annual fee based on the unit, the property, not necessarily the value of the property.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I believe only irrigation districts are capable of assessing that way. Drainage districts do. I really don't believe fire districts have that ability.
How about charging an annual service fee?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, special districts have only, as being creatures of the state, they are you have created them via statute. We have only those statutorily granted powers. So for any type of fee or ability to raise revenue has to be granted by the legislature, and I'm not aware of that type of annual service fee being permitted by the legislature.
So the fees that are used for water districts and so forth, they're specifically specified in statute?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I believe that the water districts, the way they operate on their fees, their statute specifically says that, and I'm going from memory here, a water district may levy a fee or a charge based upon water consumption or something like that. It really, it says to carry out public health or public purpose of providing potable water or something similar to that.
So it could be if we, something like this passed, you could be back seeking changes in statutes that allow you to do fees or something.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I would really hope not, but yes.
You really hope you wouldn't be back, or you hope it would pass?
Both.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's all we have signed up. Anybody else want to leap into the fray before we go home? You sure? Senator Beyer's up here.
Mr. Chair, members of the remaining members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bill Sizemore, the Executive Director of Oregon Taxpayers United. Just a few brief observations about this measure, and I'll leave it at that. We have considered the objections to previous measures, 91, for example, the full deductibility of federal income taxes. The two main complaints from opponents were that the measure benefited the wealthy unfairly. Too much of the cut went to upper-income people. Didn't buy that argument, but considered it. And also the objection was that the measure was too abrupt in its implementation. Some even accused it of being retroactive, which we didn't continue to believe that wasn't true. This measure is phased in over 5 years, and the benefit is capped so that if you have a $1 million house, you don't get all of your property taxes removed, even if you are above 65. The maximum benefit is 150% of what the average tax is on a home in your county. The measure is interesting. Probably the most interesting thing about listening to the testimony, especially from those alleging that they represent senior citizens across the state, is that we have polled this measure with a fair and accurate description of the measure, and the numbers are extremely high for seniors. And
Mr. Chair, are you questioning Jim Davis's comments that he doesn't represent seniors?
Mr. Chair,
he does represent seniors.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, I only say that he claims that he does. I don't know.
He doesn't.
Well, if he, with the chair's permission, if his indications are that his members do not support this measure, I will tell you that we have a statewide poll done by a large national firm that show about 70% support. So his members may not be the same body as the general population of voters in 65 and older in the state.
Mr. Chair. You're not questioning that he does represent seniors?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, he represents the seniors that are members of his organization. I will buy that. I didn't allege otherwise. But I obviously don't believe that he represents all seniors in Oregon.
I don't think he said that. I think he said he represented a specific senior citizen group.
Okay. I will continue. The other objections to, I mean, what I'll finish on that thought. The notion that all these senior programs would suffer as a result, you know, senior centers would suffer, programs for senior centers, senior citizens would suffer. It's one of the interesting things about property tax measures is that the opponents always claim that if this measure passes, there'll be less money to take care of seniors. Of course, senior citizens will have less money and therefore need less taken care of by government. And I think that's a consideration that the average senior voter going to the polls would have in the forefront of their mind when they made their decision about this measure. Will I lose some services? I would say that the average senior would say, I suppose so. Will I have more money in my pocket to take care of myself? Yes, I believe that to be the case, and then they would make their decision. And I think given those two considerations, only a campaign will disclose how the issue would settle. I just think that it's worth consideration that this measure does not benefit a specific demographic of the population. One of the objections I hear, let me tell you why I say that. People say, well, you're just giving a tax break to this one group. True. That one group is made up of two types of people, people who are 65 and older and people who are going to be 65 and older. So everybody's going to benefit from the measure if they live to 65, whether they are renters or whether they are owners of property. And philosophically, the reason a measure like this means a lot to an organization like ours is that we believe that the right to own private property is the real cornerstone of a free society, more so than any other right. As much as we cherish the right to free speech, etc., if you lose the right to private property ownership, you really lose your freedom. And that I know a lot of our members, we have about 22,000, feel very strongly that you don't really ever own your property if you are always renting it from the government. Always having to pay them a few $100 a month or a few $1,000s a year to keep your property. Otherwise, they take it. So we feel like it's time that we had a plan in place that allows people to actually retire as property taxpayers after they've spent 40 years of their life, say, paying property taxes for schools and for police and fire services, and even whether they use those services or not, whether they have kids in school, they've paid for the parks and the libraries and all that. That's at some point in life, we just say, we recognize all those years that you have faithfully paid in for all these government services, whether you use them or not, and we are now going to let you retire, and you stay in your house, and you don't have to pay us anymore in property taxes. And I think that's the thing about this measure that attracts it, that makes it attractive to a lot of elderly people and those of us. I mean, I'll be 50 years old in June, and I'm a ways away from 65. But I like the idea that someday, after I've paid 40 years or more of property taxes, I'll actually just own my home and won't have to pay property taxes anymore. And I think it's a good public policy choice. Voters will decide whether it's a good idea or not, but I think it is certainly quite defensible, and certainly our goals are, at least from our perspective, lofty.
Thank you. Further questions, Senator Beyer?
Softball. philosophically, Bill, is the concept that, choose gross numbers, that, and I guess one of two, people have paid for services for three quarters of their lives, and they shouldn't have to. They ought to be able to take a ride the last quarter. Is that the notion, or is it that they're not actually using services?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I think one of the things we've always struggled with property taxes is, and it's two main things, and one of them is the disconnect between the tax and the ability to pay, and the disconnect between the tax and the actual services. For example, school services. I don't see the connection between the ownership of property and schools. You may live in a $400,000 house and have no children, be 70 years old and never had any children, and you will pay maybe 10 times as much in property taxes to support schools as a family with three kids living in an apartment house. And the connection is not real. The idea, and we've actually done a lot of, I mean, people might say get a life, Bill, but we've actually done a lot of number crunching on the thing, on concepts like, what's the relationship between the value of a house and the cost of fire protection? Would someone allege, would the fire department allege, I doubt it, that a $300,000 house costs three times as much to protect from fire than a $100,000 house? Well, that would be a pretty difficult argument to make. If the $300,000 house is up to code, got sprinklers, and the $100,000 house is a fire trap, maybe got kids at the age where there's more likelihood of fires. You got smokers in the house in one, and you don't have in another. I mean, the connection between the property tax and the way we levy it ad valorem as a way we pay for services, you can make the same kinds of connections or disconnections between police services and square footage of property or value of property. Where is the connection? How real is it? Certainly there's no connection between the tax that you pay on property and your ability to pay. I mean, if you lose your job tomorrow, your property tax will go up 3%. But I have no income. But my property tax goes up 3% unless the voters voted for a local option, it might go up 15-20%. So this is a tax that we like to work ourselves away from. And if the senator just let me one more thing about that. When a measure is on the ballot that will increase revenue for a local option for schools, say, or to build a new library, I think there are a lot of senior citizens that if you ask them, they would say, I really think we need a new library. I really think that we need a new high school or more money for operations. But I can't afford it. I believe in schools. I believe in parks. I can't afford it. But if when people go to the polls, if 50% plus one vote votes, and there's a 50% turnout in a non-general election, votes for the tax increase, they're not voting to increase their tax on themselves. They're voting to increase the tax on everybody in the district because of the majority rules. And the tax gets increased not only on those who said, I like the idea and I can afford it, but it gets increased on those who say, I like the idea, but I can't afford it. And I will be turning the thermostat down and eating macaroni and cheese if this passes. That's why we continue to have wars and discussions about property taxes, is because there are so many inherent unfairnesses in the system that we need to either move away from the system entirely or at least have a vehicle for those on limited fixed incomes to be exempted from it.
Senator Brown.
Bill, I'm glad you agree that the property tax is unfair. Would you agree with me that there are a good portion of seniors on limited fixed incomes that can't afford to own property and that they will receive no benefit from this measure?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, this measure as envisioned and I believe as drafted says that senior renters will be sent a check for the same amount they would have paid had they been the owner of the property that they rent, in which case the renter is not discriminated against because he or she cannot afford a house.
Mr. Chair, how would that be calculated? Who would determine that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, the measure, and I'm not sure, there are actually a couple of versions of this, the measure actually states that what the tax is on that property, and depends, and say it's an apartment that they pay, that the check they would receive would be on the tax that would have been paid or was paid by their landlord on that square footage that they actually use, plus their pro rata percentage of the common areas and land that is jointly used by other renters. That is the concept. It's not that difficult to calculate, since the calculation is already made by the county assessor as to the tax on the building itself, and the land is separated.
Sure. Why did you choose property tax relief and not income tax relief?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, we're working on that.
And Mr. Chair, one other question.
Be careful what you ask for.
Your polling, I just thought maybe there might be an actual principal reason why you would choose one and not the other. Polling, you said you polled. Did you poll only Oregon seniors or Oregon voters?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, we did a very large sample. Normally the sample for a 3 to 4% margin of error for the entire state is about 500. Because we wanted to have demographic breakouts that would be meaningful, and we don't think they are when you only have a 500 sample, each one of the margin of error with those subsets of the whole, there's such a huge margin of error, those numbers are meaningless. So we did a 2,000 sampling poll of Oregon voters in general so that we could break that down to see how it did with people different age groups and party by gender, et cetera. So we felt comfortable that the numbers we had for senior citizens were larger than you normally have in an entire poll.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to ask one more, if I may.
Come on, I've got a meeting here in 5 minutes.
But you can go. What can I say? Bill, I raised the issue of single parents with children who are either trying to purchase homes or are on the edge of losing their homes. Have you looked at providing property tax relief for them?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, we have worked on other measures in the past that have across the board done that. Measure 47 did that for all taxpayers, 47/50, I should say. And those in those groups did benefit from that measure. The question of singling out that group for property tax relief is a difficult one to do. The general giving tax relief to everyone across the board benefits. In fact, you bring up a point that I think is for a lot of people have written me letters and asked me questions about this measure. Called in on my radio talk show. Great talk, 11:50 a.m. The 3 to 5 p.m. The
slightly
to the right of center. And they said, well, this would just result in a tax shift. Everyone else is going to have to pay what they didn't pay. And I would point out that in a technical sense, that is not the case as it would have been in before Measure 47/50. In the era prior to the 47/50, there was a 6% automatic increase in the tax base, constitutionally allowed, without voter approval. So if one particular group's taxes went down, say because even their assessed value was decreased, their market value was decreased, then the burden would automatically shift as the local governments took their 6% increase, would automatically shift to those who had not received that benefit of a lower assessment. With Measure 47/50, that is not the case. The tax on individual property, the other properties not receiving this tax break will still be limited to 3% increases in assessed value with a frozen rate. And Measure 5 limitations, so there would not be a shift to the
okay.
to your
the
people.
The answer to my question is you have not looked at initiatives that would assist low-income families with children.
Mr. Chair, we have not singling them out
okay.
as a demographic. We have helped them with
Senator
measures.
Do you have one more for us?
Do I have one?
A question for us?
No.
Okay. Then. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you for your patience. And then we'll close the public hearing next year, 41. Corey, stand up, please. I understand that you're going to depart the fix here. You going to leave town? Where are you headed? Well, we have enjoyed your service, and thank you very much. With that, we are adjourned.
You got it.
All right.